This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
I was reading today that in Korea, a bunch of pranksters, I guess, had taken seats number 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, etc., in a cinema so that people who were there on Valentine's dates had to be split up. So then I was wondering, what kind of people are going to come to this event on Valentine's Day? We can talk to you later about that. Anyway, I'm very happy you could join us here tonight for the launch of Carol Maver's book, Blue Mythologies. Carol, who teaches at the University of Manchester, has been a Cabinet contributor for, I think, 5 years, but I'm very bad with dates. And she has contributed not just to the magazine, but to other things that we've done, including the Venice Biennial catalog that we did last year. And she teaches at the University of Manchester, but she also did an MFA at UC San Diego under Eleanor Anton, David Anton, and Alan Capro. And so there's a whole background there in art making as well, which I think shows in some of the writing that she does. You may disagree with this, but we can...
Oh, I think so.
You think so? Okay.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. And in addition to the book that we are celebrating tonight, she's the author of Black and Blue, The Bruising Passion of Camera Lucida, La Jetée Sans Soleil, and Hiroshima Mon Amour. That came out in 2012. And Reading Boyishly, Roland Barthes, J.M. Barrie, Jacques-Henri Lartigue, Marcel Proust, and D.W. Winnicott. And that's from 2007. Copies of the book are there for you to peruse and to buy afterwards, and I'm going to hand over to Carol.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm so honored to be here as a great fan of Cabinet. It's really very special. So my plan is just to read a few selections from the book for about 20 minutes, and then we can have a conversation and drink more wine and beer. Well, a book on blue has to begin, I think, with Joni Mitchell. So, Blue, here is a shell for you. Inside, you'll hear a sigh, a foggy lullaby. This is your song from me. Blue Mythologies, Reflections on a Color, is a visual, literary, and cultural study of the color blue. Blue Mythologies uncloaks blue as a particularly paradoxical color. The conflicting temperaments of the blues unravel easily. For instance, blue is the purity of the Virgin Mary, yet blue names a movie as obscene. Or blue is the color of eternity, yet blue lips are a sign of approaching death. The yarn of this book takes up many hues of the color, yet the pattern remains faithful to one over and done with thread. Blue is paradoxical. It is self-contradictory, yet true. Here is a blue science fiction mythology. It is a myth that our blood is blue until it is oxygenated. Rather than the physical properties of the light itself, the blue in our veins is an affect, a cognitive characteristic of the eye and the brain. Venus blood is not in fact blue, it is deep red. However, the light which is scattered from tissue beneath the vein in the back of your hand passes through the blood on its way to our eye and emerges from the skin in a way that makes it appear blue. The effect has been coined as retinux, a portmanteau word derived from retina and cortex, Retinek's theory explains that when looking at blue veins, the eye and the brain are involved in the process of seeing. Edwin Land, the developer of Polaroid, formulated the concept in 1971. Polaroid blues are amongst the most gorgeous blues I know, like those obscene Polaroid blues of fashion art photographer Helmut Newton and Guy Burdin. Land explains why my blood looks blue and gave us the gift of the Polaroid with its stunning instant cyans. This is the kind of fluke that a connoisseur of blue can smile over. Colette has written, there are connoisseurs of blue, just as there are amateurs of wine vintages. I am trying to be a connoisseur of blue. Here is another blue science fiction mythologies. It is not, here is another blue science fiction mythology. It is not a myth that all newborn irises look blue, whatever final pigmented color they may end up with. At birth, the infant's unpigmented iris contains many molecular scatterers in a transparent medium. That is why we see a bluish eye when we look into them. Newborn babies' eyes seem blue, not because they are pigmented, but because they scatter blue light to us.
She wore blue velvet, bluer.
So, newborns' babies' eyes seem blue not because they are pigmented, but because they scatter blue light to us. Once the pigment arrives, the iris has effectively been painted, and its color is then determined by the pigment's absorption properties, not unlike the blue crystals in the starred ceiling of Giotto's Arena Chapel, which absorb color in white light, leaving only blue to be reflected to us. Possibly one of the best angels ever. What is he doing? I could just look at this all night. The blue sky in Wyoming absorbs nothing but scatters the blue of sunlight down to us, not unlike the newborn eyes of babies. In sum, a baby's blue eyes are scattered light. Paul Newman's two blue eyes are absorbed light. I am a male satin bowerbird. As a connoisseur of blue, like the collectomaniac box artist Joseph Cornell, a magpie for blue, I perform my text like the artistically determined male satin bowerbird. Australia's male satin bowerbird is famous for constructing and decorating richly decorated bowers, some even with interiors painted blue. Birds of this species have been observed painting with blueberry juice, using crude brushes made of sticks and moss. The blue objects are collected to bring the female bird in. The older and more experienced the male, the better and more beautiful the blue bower. These bowers are bachelor pads for mating. They are not nests for a family. Once copulation has taken place, the female is on her way to a life of single parenthood. Not that long ago, an ornithologist observed this in just one bower. 75 blue plastic items, including tops from ballpoint pens, plastic pegs, bottle tops, a toothbrush, and parts of broken toys, together with 15 blue-edged feathers, 10 dried snail shells, several pieces of fawn-colored twine, and two blue marbles. Four long strands of blue wool were so placed as to lead into and through the avenue, the center of the bower, which is open on both ends. Also decorating the platform, the inside floor of the bower, were blue and cream green flowers and other perishable items, which were replaced during the breeding season. Small blue ornaments, including flowers, were scattered along the floor of the avenue. In 1865, Dante Gabriel Rossetti painted his beloved Fanny Cornforth in a blue bower. Rossetti's nickname for this blousy redhead bird was Little Elephant. A plump beauty with bee-stung lips, if she had lived during our time, she would have sent Lucian Freud into some competitive bower building. My essays, long and short, are blue bowers that perform the mythology of blue as paradoxical, like the cornflowers at the entrance of Rossetti's blue bower, ornaments to lead in. Let me draw you inside. The ink that I use is the blue blood of the swan that blossoms and blooms into blues within blues, including Eve Klein's blue anthropometries, Gainsborough's The Blue Boy, the copy editor's blue pencil, the blue nose of morality, blue movies, blue stockings, examination booklets, and cheese. My ink bleeds the ice blue of glaciers, the struggle of blue-collar workers, the authority of blue coats, the snobbery of aristocratic blue blood, the incomprehensible violence of the blue eyes of the Aryan race of the Nazi regime, the struggles of the blue man, Blumen, of the 13th and 14th centuries, who today would be called a black man, the beauty of the scattered light of the sky and the sea, the light that got lost, the crystalline intensity of the filtered blue of the Virgin's lapis lazuli cloak in Piero della Francesca's Madonna del Parto, the optimism of the blue of the aster, the iris in the hand of Vincent van Gogh, the pursuit of Novalis's blue morning flower, and the air of Fichte's bruised. Sometimes it seems that everything is blue. In 1972, the Apollo 17 astronauts took a photograph of the Earth with the sun behind them. Floating in black space, the Earth appeared as a blue marble, and they named the photograph as such. Astronauts are trained not to go insane when they see the Earth round and blue, smaller than their porthole. Rebecca Solnit has remarked that the world is blue at its edges and its depths. The indigo milk cap, Lactarius indigo, is one of the few naturally blue foods. Like mushrooms of the Lactarius genus, when bruised or scratched, the fungus cries tears of indigo milk. It is difficult to believe that the indigo milk cap is edible. Some even say delicious. Blue is the color of my memory of my dreams. I return to Moreau's 1925 photo on which underneath a little island of thick blue paint, Moreau has written in lovely black script, "This is the color of my dreams." Photo in French and English is a snapshot. This is a snapshot of my dreams. It is blue at its edges and in its depths. Blue is the color of memory. I close my eyes and I remember a really blue time from my childhood. I am remembering the blue eyes of a fawn. My family was vacationing in the summer of the Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming, where lakes and ponds and even the nearby thermal pools at Yellowstone National Park are like blue eyes staring at the blue sky. I have seen such eyes of the earth in California, North Carolina, New Zealand, and England. Here's a frozen one from Wales, as photographed by Helen Sear in January 2011, about which she writes of moving 1 foot gingerly after the other towards the center of your eye. I was with my mother when suddenly out of the blue, a photographer weighed down with equipment appeared. He asked us if we wanted to see a fawn that had been left alone while its mother had gone to look for food. Mysteriously and uncharacteristically from my mother, we quickly agreed to follow this unknown man who looked a little dangerous to me. And as if in a fairy tale, we came upon one of the most beautiful things that I'd ever seen in my entire life, a fawn so young that its soft fur appeared moist. Its white spots looked magical and royal, inversions of the ermine trim of the fairy tale king's robe. Tiny blue forget-me-nots were flourishing around this beautiful thing, curled up upon itself in perfect sleep, rocking to the rhythm of its heart and lungs. But were the flowers really there, I wonder? Don't touch, the photographer whispered to me. The fawn's eyes were shut off from the world by a pair of soft brown almond-shaped curtains. I could not see its eyes, but I remember them as blue. My memory is cast in the blue of the wide-open skies of Wyoming, the delicate flowers, and the fawn's unseen eyes. My memory is blue at its edges and in its depths. The fawn's eye, from this fawn's eye, from the taxidermist, is in my mind's eye, the ideal photo, in Moreau's sense of the term, of that day I remember as so blue. A blue lollipop. In Krzysztof Kieślowski's 1993 film, Julie makes corrections, blue notes in blue pen upon the black notes of her late husband's musical score. The blue ink stains her fingers like blood. Julie, like all seven of the characters in Kieślowski's trilogy of three films, Blue, Red, White, turns out to be the only survivor of a ferry accident. They did not drown in the blue sea, but they are all dark and all wear that polar blue, bruised underwater look. God made the sea to look through the window. Driving, 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 living, living, living. A young daughter who lives in a blue room at home is dreamy and is holding the silver and blue wrapper of a lollipop recently devoured out of the window. The wrapper flashes as a greeting, but we sense it as a goodbye to the world. There is something in the air. It catches small bits of light and flashes. It is luminescent despite the day's gray-blue sky. Its crackling sound and its silver-blue color are satisfying. As Julia Kristeva notes, color is bodily. It's erotic. It comes from the body, like voice. Anna lets go of the wrapper. Anna and her father will soon be dead. A car accident. We hear the sound of the crash before we see anything. The bad luck of life. The mother will survive. The bad luck of life. The mother cannot survive because she cannot mourn. Not long after this tragedy, the mother returns to the home where she had once lived happily with her husband and her daughter, Anna. It is night. Almost everything has been cleared out of the house. She empties her handbag on the bare mattress and finds, by chance, another one of those blue lollipops, which happens to be shaped like a tongue, as you'll see. She had been saving it for her daughter, but that daughter is dead, so she eats it herself. It's not a Proustian bite. It's a terrible devouring, a way to try to hold that child that she's lost. Anna's blue mobile that belonged to her little girl is the same color and texture of Roger Hehorn, the amazing artist's 2000 installation of copper sulfite crystals writ large, entitled Seizure. Sorry, Julie's crystals in her hand, but this is now a shot from the interior of Seizure, which I'll explain here, 2008. For this remarkable project, Hehorns took a tiny, condemned, depressing, too small, worn-out council flat near Elephant and Castle in South London and turned its interior into a sparkling blue jewel, a blue grotto. The effect of walking into the semi-darkness of the small habitat is to be struck again by Giotto's blue, only in London in the 21st century. Hehorn's is a tiny chapel or palace covered with thousands upon thousands of sapphires, a meeting between the Arena Chapel, Giotto's Arena Chapel, and St. Mark's Basilica, writ small and cheap. The blue sparkle was achieved by flooding the interior of the flat with 75,000 liters of copper sulfate solution. It did not take long for the bathtub, as you see here, the walls, the floor, and the ceiling to be taken over by a mesmerizing and menacing growth of gorgeous crystals. Nor did it take long for the Pilgrims of Blue to make the journey to 157 Harper Road, including myself. In keeping with the mythology of blue, Seizure is as foreboding as it is beautiful. Likewise, the liquid pools of milky turquoise approach the abject. Hehorn's council flat, bejeweled with the grandeur, as well as the ill-omened fragments and liquidy rank of Venice, is today's equivalent of painting with light, not from lapis lazuli crystals, but from copper sulfate crystals. Okay. Now, in conclusion, Utopia is a nowhere land, a nowhere island, yet we keep trying to get there. It is always unfinished. Frederick Jameson likens Utopia's always already unfinished essence with the pleasures of construction found in the garage workshop of the home mechanic, erector sets of Lego, of bricolating and cobbling together things of all kinds in a never-ending variation, led by new ideas and information. These utopian constructions convey the spirit of non-alienated labor and production. Jameson's utopias, without an end in sight, are hopeful in that which Roland Barthes identifies as radical, successful idleness, or good laziness. In Barthes' inspiring interview entitled Dare to be Lazy, Barthes bricolates on knitting, where he writes, "Perhaps the most unconventional and thus the most literally scandalous thing I ever saw in my life, scandalous for the people watching, not for me, was a young man seated in a subway car in Paris who pulled some knitting out of his bag and openly began to knit. Everyone felt scandalized, but no one said anything. Now, knitting is the perfect example of a manual activity that is minimal, gratuitous, without finality, but that still represents a beautiful and successful idleness." Francis Elise, that you're looking at here, took it one step further with his fairy tale action as he walked through Stockholm whilst unraveling behind him the blue sweater that he was wearing to make a trail not of pebbles or breadcrumbs, but of yarn. Elise spins his own yarn on the action when he comments that in Stockholm, once the walk was done and the sweater unraveled, I retraced my steps to document the journey, following the long blue thread on the street and in the park. Midway back, I ran into this old lady who was patiently rolling a blue yarn under her arm, carefully gathering up the wool of my unraveled sweater, maybe to knit a similar one at home. Like blue mythologies, Elise is a man who knits, unknits out of the blue. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Carol, for a fantastic talk. And I don't know if there are questions, comments, thoughts. If there are, share the mic here.
I noticed you cited and used Julia Kristeva a lot. And in Giotto's Joy and the Desire of Language, she talks about how blue is received during before the mirror stage in a child's eye through the serrated margin and all that. But she conjectures that we see blue not from a not so much a dehumanized standpoint, but the opposite, more like a depersonalized standpoint. Do you agree? What are your thoughts on that? Is there any more research on the if we see blue and it brings us back to before the mirror stage, before the personal stage?
That's a really good question. I don't know if any of you have read this. It's such a complicated essay by Kristeva entitled Giotto's Joy. And she doesn't really footnote in that sort of French style. And I really love that story that we're kind of lost in the blue before we discover language and enter the mirror stage and get all hung up with sexuality and death and so forth. But I don't know of any scientific evidence to prove that. What does interest me, and I think I got thinking about in relationship to that, is with, now I'm blanking on his name, but Amy will remember, yes you will, it's a Duke author, Color Patch Blue is Color Patch, I'll think of it in a minute, but he writes... in his book, I can't remember his name, I could look it up for you though, but just the idea that it's not what you're saying exactly, but that in memory we remember things as more intense in our color. So he talks a lot about how in our memory we remember things as more blue, as almost too blue. So it's this kind of romanticized idea, but I think kind of interesting how we recolor it maybe in our memory. And that's why I talked about that story of the blue fawn, which I swear there were blue flowers around it, but why? I mean, I think it's some kind of romantic idea of the color blue. But she seems to suggest we see blue differently before pigment sets in. And I asked a medical research about that. Because I wanted to get all that stuff about the blue blood and the blue eyes right. So I turned to him, and he said, no, I don't think so.
We're actually editing a text at the moment, which is in part about the acquisition of color in language, both sort of phylogenetically and in terms of the individual. And Paul and Kay, who've sort of the people who've done a lot of work on this, not all of it to be trusted, they have this idea that any language that only has two words for color will have black and white. And the third color you pick up is actually not blue, but red.
Yeah.
And then it's green or yellow, so you'll pick up one of those, and then the other one, depending on which one you picked up first. And then, at that point, is when blue comes in. And it's a very fixed scale that they have, that they think they can show evolutionarily, but also in terms of the way an infant picks it up. I don't believe this, but I'm just putting it out there.
But
there are theories
stories,
about
yeah.
exactly how.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I'm not an expert on any of this, but the Greeks, you know, some people say, oh, they had no word for the color blue, but right. because they said the sea was wine-colored. But then it's about language, and then people yeah. have done research, and it has to do with yeah. how
wasn't the
wine...
dawn wasn't dawn pink, according to them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Rosy.
Rosy.
Rosy,
yeah. yeah.
Other questions, thoughts?
It just seems to me, although I haven't read your book yet,
but
by
you
the
will.
Description, I am definitely going to, because I used to give the book by William Gass as a gift on being blue. And his is this kind of rant. It begins with like a kind of rantishness and much mm-hmm. more. And I think that from what your book seems to describe is a narrative that goes into deeper corners and understandings mm-hmm. about it, as opposed to just in language mm-hmm. and making these comparisons mm-hmm. that our generation makes, perhaps.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but I think that they're nice. As a comparative, the language
absolutely.
Of them.
Gass's book on being blue. If you haven't read it, you must. It's a poem. It's beautiful and really got me thinking about the color. And that is his line: the air, the fist is
like
bruised.
So,
yes,
exactly.
And these great lists and. Really, really wonderful.
Yours is very intricate, where you go into biographies of artists or of places, of things that you visited. And
mm-hmm. I slow it down, and you know, I really look at the image, maybe, that he talks about.
Yeah.
And try to take it somewhere. Yeah.
A new gift book for artists.
Yeah, because that sounds good to me.
Speaking of which, there are copies back there. Any other thoughts, questions?
Or maybe people just want a drink, which is fine.
Maybe they want a drink.
Yeah, I love to talk to people individually.
Okay.
I'm wondering if the obvious thing being that the heavens, the ubiquity of blue, which
yeah.
is, I don't know if it's in your book, but the idea that it seems to make sense for the first time that it would be the color least reached for, because it almost seems like colors exist in... as opposed to it.
Yeah, I think that's why I showed the blue marble, the Apollo 17 picture, because, well, actually, everything is blue when you see it. And I think, yeah, it is the Earth in a sense, or it is where we are, and everything is in relationship.
Everything.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's a problem writing a book like this. It didn't seem like everything was blue. I didn't know that, you know. No, that's a good point. That's good.
Thank you for reading. Did you come across any critiques of blue? And did any of those critiques mention Facebook blue?
What is Facebook blue?
Carol.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to stay away, so I got my writing done.
You mean as a corporate color?
No, I think, I mean, maybe there are a lot of blue haters, and that's fine here. But
they're all here.
Blue is a pretty color that, it is a very popular color, and I think it has to do with the sun and the sky and the ocean. But certainly, like, the what is that called, like, when you have the video on, and it's just the blue screen, right? and maybe, you know, Derek Jarman's film Blue. That's all you see when he does this beautiful voiceover that tells the story of stories of Blue, but also what he's experiencing dying from AIDS. So that therapy seems to take sort of this very romantic idea of Blue, but at the same time to this critique of the culture in which he's living and the devastation that he's experiencing. So it's painful to watch.
The Romans held Blue in a low regard. The Romans held Blue in a low regard. This case for Blue.
Yes, yes. So you can think about that. There's a really nice book by Pastora, just book on Blue, which is very good. The sort of hatred and fear of Blue.
I was maybe a little bit connected to that comment. I'm going to guess that the Romans had a distaste for Blue because it's connected to Saturn. I'm wondering, you know, different cultures have different relationships to various colors, and certain colors have dominance and favor. I was wondering what you encountered in your research that seemed interesting or surprising to you. I feel like the romance of Blue has a particularly kind of Western European provenance.
That's right, and those are the texts and images that I deal with, also German and French and American and English. But, I mean, I am very interested. I want to emphasize on the paradox of Blue, that Blue is the color of death, you know, or Blue is the color of mold, and Blue has a kind of very abject sense to it. So I do quite a close reading of, say, Death in Venice and the abject and the color blue there. So that's what interests me, is that it's paradoxical. I think it is, maybe I'm wrong, I think it's the most paradoxical, at least in our culture, of the colors, and having these sort of opposite associations. You know, when a baby's lips start to turn blue, we panic.
Any other questions?
I was going to ask you a question that maybe not be good. I was going to ask you about Barth and the book, obviously.
My boyfriend? You want to hear my dreams about Barth?
Sure, yes. Let's end with your dreams on Barth. Are they blue dreams?
They're not blue. Yeah. You did hold my hand.
But really? Wow. So Blue Mythology is obviously referenced as a particular book of his.
Yes.
And in some sense, do you think your book is it aligned to that mode of Barth, that early Barth, or is it the sort of later Barth that you're interested in? Because the essayistic kind of...
Oh, right, okay.
You know, mm-hmm. The question of writing style and the Barth that you're interested in.
Yes. Barth himself is very paradoxical in his own writing. So the idea of Blue Mythologies comes out of Barth's book from the late 50s entitled Mythologies, where he looks at something like, you know, wine or milk and shows them as being particularly paradoxical. But he wants everything to be paradoxical. He loves to find the opposite in everything. So that's been a mode of operation, the sort of neither-nor-ism since the beginning. But really, his early books like Michelet or Pleasure of the Text, they're quite essayist as well. I think we think about like the text in image music text and the fashion system. But he was flipping back and forth all the way. So I would say both. I mean, Camera Lucida, his last published book, is a great example of that paradox, that the photograph gives us eternal life. Our grandmother is there as a little girl forever. We can hold on to her. It is also, paradoxically, the death of the moment. You know, it's that kind of opposition. So all of Barth, yeah, I love, except for the fashion system, like that one.
So tell us about the dream.
And oh, the dream. Okay. Well,
do you want more spotlights?
Yeah, yeah. it was just a simple dream, but he was holding a seminar, and I was really excited to go. And he, and we all sitting around the table. He had like come back from the dead, you know, and it was sort of like the return, that TV show. He was there, but it was very pleasant. And he asked me to sit next to him, and he held my hand, and he was really nice about my French. And I woke up really happy.
Had you finished the book at the time?
Yes, I think I had. Yes, yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Carol.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you so much. There are copies of the book there on sale tonight, and Carol, I think, will be happy to sign them.
I will.
Yes.
They're being sold by my son.
I was equipped with some card reader. So.
Yeah.
And we'll have some wine and beer in the back as well.
Thank you
all for coming. Thank you.